Welcome to SNI Digital Innovations in Learning in association with UCLA Neurosurgery. Linda Liao, Chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. The lecture and discussion is on neuro-ophthalmology, orbital and neuro-ophthalmic examination, pearls for the neurosurgeon. The lecturer is Justin Carlin, UCLA Health Sciences Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology, Division of Orbital and Ophthalmic Plastic Surgery, Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center, Los Angeles, California, United States of America.
So I'm Justin Carlin. I'm in the Department of Oculoplastic Surgery, but I sort of dabble sometimes in the neuro-ophthalmology. I have an interest in it. I don't see a lot of those patients necessarily, but I find it really interesting. So I hope this will be relevant to you, especially for the residents and the trainees, because the truth of the matter is, you know, when you have a busy night on call, you have to gather accurate and useful information, okay? That's the key. You don't have a lot of time. You're getting blown up from all different directions. So you have to be able to identify what it is you're seeing and then how you can use that information to make a decision without it actually being inaccurate and therefore dangerous. Okay, so I'm going to try to help sharpen your observation skills a little bit. And then I'll present hopefully some clinical radiologic correlations for you. And that's what's going to be, I think, in your career, especially if you end up alone in Wyoming, you don't have access to like high level neuro-ophthalmology. Hopefully this can help you with your surgical planning, narrow your differential, assess the patient's functioning ahead of time, you know, on your own so you could see it with your own eyes. And also for medical legal reasons, before you embark on an operation, it's a good idea to have documented what the patient's vision might be, what the patient's motility, these sorts of things. And so I'll show you how to gather that information, okay? And when you do operate afterwards, I know it's very important to assess your own outcome, and vision being such an important, and motility is such an important part of people's function, understanding how to assess the vision is going to be important in assessing your postoperative evaluation and then rehab, okay? So I'll paraphrase what Harvey Cushing said. He said the ophthalmologists, which were the first surgical subspecialties, neurosurgeons, which are the latest, sort of meet at the border of the optic foramen. And we look at each other kind of a little bit askance at what our roles are, but we know that we're both working on the same thing. So this is the structure of the talk. I'll go through so I can make it kind of clear to you some of the, this is how I structure the way that I do an exam as well when I see patients. So we'll start with the afferent system. Afferent just means vision. What's a patient's vision? How do they see? What are they seeing? If you have the opportunity to take a history in a patient with a visual complaint, you want to know, is there a change? Is it one eye or both? Where in the visual field? A lot of times patients can't even express it. But if you can get that information, it's useful for the bottom part, which is neurologic localization. Where is the actual problem so that you can then determine what to do next? So, you know, any patient can have anything from cataract to optic atrophy to a, you know, cholesterol aneurysmal bone cyst to a occipital tumor that can cause vision loss. Harry Traquair, the Scottish ophthalmologist, described the way we see, and I think the best understanding that I have is that most of our sensitivity is in that central 10 degrees. He called it an island or a hill of vision, okay? And that corresponds to most of 90% of the axons that are in your optic nerve function to serve the macula, the very center of the vision, and your brain kind of fills in the rest, okay? So there's the macula, which is that center, about 10, 15 degrees of your vision. And then there's extramacular, which is the visual field. So this is how the computer works. Okay. This is how the software works. Okay. So when you examine someone's eye, do one eye at a time. if you can actually get that information from them one eye at a time. And the way you can do that in the clinic, the way we do it is I give patients a NEAR card, or I have them look at the Snellen chart. I can check their color vision. But if you're at the bedside and you don't have a lot of time, I'll show you some ways to do it. But basically, you can give them a target and see if they can follow it with each eye. Okay, it's called fix and follow. Okay, cover one eye, move a target around, see if they can follow it around. Another thing is that I think is really gives you kind of a global assessment is if the patient can give you information, look at my nose. Okay, how much of my face can you see? You know, you can do one eye at a time, cover one eye with your palm, cover how much of my face can you see? That gives you an idea of what's going on about the central 10, 15 degrees of vision. Now, can you see my eyes? Can you see my nose? And again, you're just trying to gather information as quickly as possible. So I have a few of these kind of quizzes around, especially for the residents. For those of you who've seen my slides already now for 4 years, like, forgive me because it's a lot of the same examples. But does anybody know what I'm trying to get at here, what this is called? Joe?
Tersen syndrome?
Yep, Tersen syndrome. So that's when you get a subarachnoid hemorrhage and that tracks forward to the macula, and patients can have significant loss of vision at the level of the retina because of this sort of boat-shaped subhyoid hemorrhage. And that can actually end up quite scarred, and they can lose vision permanently for that. So this is important to assess. So we talked about macular function, which is sort of that center 10, 15 degrees. For outside the macula, it's going to be the visual fields. Again, one eye at a time. When you're in the clinic, you have all kinds of tools. Okay, we have, one they use in neurology, they ask the patient to draw something. And that gives a lot of information as to what they actually perceive. Okay, but at the bedside, it's not so easy. Or with children for that matter. So what you can do, again, one eye at a time, you can ask a patient to imitate. If you're going to ask them to count the fingers, you should only use 1, 2, or 5. 1, 2, or 5, because it's really hard to tell the difference between 3 and 4. Or even 1 and 2, and then 2 and 5, and 1 and 5. So 1, 2, or 5, and then you cover one eye, and then you can do it in the periphery. We'll practice on each other, okay? Obviously, blink to threat. You can ask a patient to, you know, cover one eye and then say, okay, do you see this? And then if they look, that gives you some information. Okay, so when you do check vision, it's important to check both of those systems, the center as well as the periphery. Okay, why send a patient for formal visual fields? Obviously, this is for early detection of lesions and what the functional ramifications would be. And this used to be the only way for anatomic localization, and it still has value today because sometimes what something looks like on a scan is not necessarily correlated to what it actually does to a patient's vision. So something might be growing on an MRI, but it may not necessarily have an impact on what you would expect with the visual center. So it's important to assess that. It can narrow your differential diagnosis. It can help you monitor the patient's progression, as I mentioned, and also it can sometimes reveal hidden vision loss that you didn't expect based on what you know about the patient's imaging. So Harvey Cushing, who's definitely one of my heroes, he really understood the star power. You know, today a lot of people are trying to do their Instagram, and he got that 100 years ago. So he was in Time magazine. He had articles written about it. He made sure that whenever he was photographed, that he always looked really good. If you go online onto YouTube, he actually filmed his 2000th operation. I don't know if you've seen this. Have you seen? It's incredible. It's about a half an hour long video about his 2000th confirmed brain tumor. And they show the whole surgery. I mean, it's like Babcock by Babcock. Like, it really is amazing. So if you have a chance, just go to YouTube and look up Harvey Cushing's 2000th operation. But he said bitemporal visual field defects are the signature of chiasmal disease. And it's so true. And he worked closely with multiple ophthalmologists to painstakingly describe the variation in visual field defects with a variety of lesions, with particular attention paid to chiasmal disease. This was an arc perimeter that was used by Clifford Walker. I won't go through the history this time, but you can look through it later in the slides. But one thing that was interesting was Wollaston, who was one of the first ones to really report about crossing of fibers at the chiasm, actually himself had a brain tumor and went up there and said, this has been my experience with what it's like to have a bitemporal. Okay, so anatomy quiz. we're looking at the cella and the anterior clinoids. But you see those question marks. Can somebody tell me what those structures are there? It's where the chiasm kind of sits. What's that called? Limbus, right? Exactly. And so limbus is the word for anterior and posterior limbus, and limbus is the word for border, like limbo, limbus. Okay, limbo. When you talk about the relationship of the chiasm to the cella, we generally describe it in three different orientations. Okay, the chiasm is always anterior to the infundibulum, but in relation to where the gland is, the chiasm can be in front of the gland in the cella, over the gland in the cella, or it can be posterior to the gland in the cella. It just depends on the sort of the intracranial length of the optic nerve. Okay. I think this is an even better diagram looking from above, I suppose, showing there on the bottom where the orientation of the chiasm is in relation to the cella. Okay. So we know that from below, from above, you can have various lesions that can impinge on the chiasm. You can even have intraaxial chiasmal disease. Everybody's seen this diagram. Not every patient reads the textbook, but generally you can reason out based on what you see on the imaging and what you know in this diagram to correlate what the patient has on psychophysical testing with what's on the imaging. So here's an example of a patient, let's say with a post-fixed chiasm, where the chiasm is posterior to the cella and posterior to the gland, meaning that you have a longer intracranial optic nerve segment. And let's say that there's a lesion coming from below that's pressing on just one optic nerve. You may expect that you would have a defect in only perhaps one portion of the optic nerve, one portion of the visual field of one eye. This is the so-called traquair scotoma, which is sort of a temporal hemianopia in one eye. Okay, traquair scotoma. Then if you move, wait a second. Let me see if I can. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to share my whole screen. I don't feel like I'm using my presenter notes because I have quizzes for you. And good. So this is the so-called junctional scotoma. So the last one we saw, again, post-fixed chiasm affecting one of the nerves would cause something like this. If it's the nerve and part of the chiasm, it really might take out one visual field completely and then also part of the other one. This is called the junctional scotoma. And then I have another quiz for you if anybody can tell me what this lesion might be. Maya? Yeah, that's right. Tubercular meningioma. Okay, so when the chiasm is oriented just superior to the gland in the cella, you would expect a bitemporal. And the bitemporal can be partial, can be superior, can be inferior. It can be the whole thing and dense. If it's a prefixed chiasm, meaning a short intracranial length of the optic nerve, meaning the chiasm is oriented anterior to the cella, it means any lesion that's coming from above or below onto the chiasm might then impinge on the tracts. And if it impinges on the tract, you would expect it would cause more of a homonymous. Okay, this is a case I saw in residency. He had presented to an outside ophthalmologist endorsing vision loss on one side. And the ophthalmologist had ordered an MRI. And while he was waiting, he showed up to the emergency room with acute vision loss. And the worst vision you can have, us ophthalmologists describe, the very bottom is NLP, no light perception. And oftentimes that's like pretty much the point of no return. Once you have NLP, it's like you can't really come back from that. Okay, NLP. So this is pituitary apoplexy. And in this case, it affected one optic nerve preferentially and the other one was normal, as you can see on that little cartoon visual field there. One common, if you go and look at Harvey Cushing's records, when he took pictures of patients, I think this is so cool. He almost very often showed the hands. So when he would take pictures in his records, because he felt like the hands gave a lot of information. So you may notice, and then these descriptions of the patients are, it really is fascinating. This to me was particular. This is another case of apoplexy. This patient came in with what looks like an adenoma, absence of secondary sexual characteristics, with complete vision loss in one eye and a very small island in the other eye, and had the hematoma evacuated, did better, and then passed away shortly thereafter. And then you have not only the clinical photo, you've got the radiology, the visual field, the autopsy, and the histopath. I mean, and this was meticulous records for every patient. I think this is, it contributed so much to the understanding of medicine in general that, you know, meticulous record keeping is such an important, important habit to develop. Okay. This is a 72-year-old man with a bitemporal hemianopia. Can anybody tell me what this one is? Based on the histopathology? Joe? Craniopharyngioma, right. So there are two types of craniopharyngioma. Okay. Do you know the two types? Adamantinomatous, right? And the way you can tell that is, I think the adamantinomatous has calcifications, which are those purple things. Okay. I have a lot more notes in here. So when you look at my slides, if you ever get a chance, there's a lot of information here for you, but I don't want to dwell on it too much because we don't have a lot of time. Okay, this is a demonstrates a glioblastoma of the occipital lobe, causing a inferior right quadrantanopia, homonymous. Homonymous means it's the same in both eyes, okay? So this is a 23-year-old woman who, and this is a case you might see, okay? This is a case you might see in real life, who was noted by the optometrist to have bilateral optic disc swelling and enlarged blind spot, and on imaging had low-lying cerebellar tonsils and an empty cella. And she had this phenomenon called, when she had transient blurry vision when she stands up or bends over, which is any cause of swelling of the optic nerves, whether it's due to increased intracranial pressure or due to something intrinsic to the nerve, may cause this phenomenon of the symptom of transient blurry vision when they stand up, okay? Which is called TVO, or transient visual obscurations. So this is IIH, a patient who will start with an enlarged blind spot that moves progressively as the pressure on the nerve remains for longer periods of time into a constricted visual field. It's very rare for somebody with IIH or actually elevated intracranial pressure in general to lose vision completely. Almost always it comes down to like a, you know, very constricted field, but they almost never lose vision completely. It's one of the few conditions, like glaucoma's like that too. And so elevated intracranial pressure and glaucoma are like cousins. Elevated intracranial pressure is glaucoma of the brain, and then glaucoma, there's glaucoma of the eye. And they both have this same kind of visual field pattern where patients often go down to a very, like looking through a straw, okay? But focal neurologic deficits in patients with IIH is uncommon. And this, like I said, this is called TVO, or transient visual obscurations, okay? It's sort of like orthostatic hypotension of the nerves. So when they stand up or they change positions, they kind of, the vision goes out and comes back, okay? Gray out, brown out, black out, something like that.
For the eye.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Okay. And we'll talk a little more about the neuroimaging of elevated ICP later on. So, and we'll talk a little bit about pseudo-pseudotumor. Okay. Pseudotumor is another term for IIH, but you always have to watch out for pseudo-pseudotumor, which is looks like IIH, looks like elevated intracranial pressure, but is actually just weird optic nerves. Okay. We'll talk a bit about that later. So that kind of covers some of the afferent system. Okay, I think we're pretty much on time. Then we'll delve a bit into the ocular motor system, which has many different little software packages that go into controlling how the eye moves. Okay. There's the movement range, which is important. There's how the eyes are aligned when you fixate on a target, either centrally or eccentrically. Then we're not going to talk about gaze holding, nystagmus, kind of smooth pursuit versus saccades. But I just want to talk about kind of the big things about how to assess eye movement. If a patient has double vision, there are a few key questions that you have to ask. First of all, does it go away when you cover one eye? And then if they can tell you, what's the orientation of the two images in relation to each other? If they can tell you, I brought a prism and some, so we can play around with kind of what it looks like to have double vision, just so you can kind of get an idea. And in case you're curious. And then if they can answer that question, the orientation, then you can ask, well, which, when you look in a certain direction, is it worse? And you can kind of turn their head and assess that. Not always possible, but if you can. And here's a, based on the, binocularity versus monocular, binocular suggests something intracranial, typically infratentorial, diplopia, that's monocular, something in the eye. Okay. Rarely it's something in the brain. Very rarely it can happen. Monocular diplopia or triplopia can happen very rarely due to certain conditions in the brain, but very, very rare. I think this diagram is great because it shows the three axes along which the eye rotates. Okay. And then there are muscles to do all of those things. In general, the degrees of movement are listed here. So when it comes to looking in the horizontal direction, it's about 50 degrees. And I'll show you what that looks like. So it's about 50 degrees horizontally. And then looking down, it's about 45. And then looking up, actually, your ability to look up decreases with age. Okay, that's sort of age dependent loss of up gaze, just so you can get some idea. When you're in the clinic, we have a million different ways to look at motility. You can put two filters on the eyes with light. You can, there's these things called HESS screens and so forth. But if you're at the bedside, I'm going to give you some tricks to be able to assess what the alignment is and maybe even see more subtle changes if you need to. Okay. And there's something called the Hirschberg test. Okay. The Hirschberg test is where you shine a light into both patient's eyes, and then you look at where the light reflexes in relation to the pupil or the limbus. And this can give you some general idea of what the positioning of the eyes, and we can practice on each other just so you can get some idea. If that light reflex or the reflection off of the cornea is at about the limbus, what we call our limbus, which is the border of the iris and the sclera, that's about 45 degrees. Okay. So you can shine a light and ask the patient to look, and then you can see if the light reflex is oriented at the same place. It's not quantitative, but it can give you some idea. Okay. It's called the Hirschberg test. We can practice that. So here's a case study of a patient with a complete ptosis. And then when you lift up the eye, it looks like unopposed action of the superior oblique and lateral rectus. And you can't really see the pupils here, but if you could, you might assume that this is a complete third nerve palsy. And this patient has a posterior communicating aneurysm. There's this Twitter account called, her name is Leah Alihali. She's a neuroradiologist. She makes these really for people like me who don't see aneurysms a lot, but want to learn about it. I think it's really nice the way that she describes. So it's a cartoon about what the risk is of rupture. And if you want to, I can send you her. It's really cool. So she kind of talks about it in a way that I can understand. But obviously the most common reason for cranial nerve 3, one of the more common reasons for cranial nerve 3 palsy is a posterior communicating artery aneurysm. And there are obviously multiple different types, usually at the junction of the posterior communicating and the carotid. Here's an example of a third nerve palsy in a left third nerve palsy partial in a child with aqueductal stenosis. That was from Harvey Cushing's case log. So here's the course of the third nerve, and just about everywhere along the pathway, it's possible to have a lesion. And there are the various segments. So when the third nerve exits the midbrain, it exits into the interpeduncular fossa. And then there's the there's a so-called cisternal segment, which is an intraparticular cistern, a perimesencephalic cistern. And then there are sort of two segments there before it gets into the oculomotor triangle here, which is, or the porus, which is this, it's between, and Juan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's between I'll read it from here, anterior petroclinoid fold, the interclinoidal fold, and the posterior petroclinoidal fold is where it enters into the dura and into the cavernous sinus. And if you were to peel open that, the porus, you can see that it's lined by arachnoid. Okay. And that's a so-called trigonal segment as it enters into the triangle. Then, and here you can see, especially on the right of the screen, the intimate relationship between the cranial nerve 3 and the posterior communicating artery before it enters into the dura. So again, here you can see the relationship between the cranial nerve 3 and the posterior communicating artery, even before it enters into the dura, into the porus, into that oculomotor triangle beneath the anterior petroclinoidal fold. Here's sort of peeling away some of the dura and then again showing all those different segments along the way. So there's sort of this portion of cranial nerve 3 that's sort of exposed in the perimesencephalic cistern, and that makes it liable to be compressed or stretched or damaged. Okay, we'll see that later on also, but that's sort of one of the vulnerable points to compression of cranial nerve 3. And obviously, as it enters into the orbital apex, it splits into the superior and inferior. The inferior has the pupillary fibers, and usually, but earlier on, the pupillary fibers actually around the periphery of the nerve. Pupillary fibers are periphery. The middle of the nerve are the motor fibers. Okay, so the parasympathetics are on the outside. Okay, here's another case study of a patient, of a man who comes in with diplopia, both eyes, for getting worse over maybe the course of a year, and he states that his diplopia, he's able to articulate that his diplopia is worse looking right and down. So I've shown on the top right of the screen, in each direction of gaze, there's sort of a maximal action of a given muscle. And so if you see a defect in a certain gaze, you can presume that that muscle is affected. Okay. I'll direct your attention to the bottom left of the screen, where you can see that the left eye is not going down enough, not as much as the right. Okay. And it's worse on head tilt to the left side. Okay, but it gets better with the right head tilt. Does anybody have any idea what this could be?
Gosh, the trochlear nerve.
That's right. Very good. Which side?
The left side.
So left superior oblique is most activated on depression and adduction. Okay, depression, adduction is the superior oblique muscle. Here, the patient ended up having I will have to look at my notes, but he has a tumor in the pineal region. Sorry, a tumor in the pineal region that's hitting the sort of the dorsal part of the pons and midbrain, and that's, as you'll see, that's where the that's what makes cranial nerve 4 unique, is that it exits dorsally, kind of moving around into the perimesencephalic cistern. And then this is a paper which had very specific MRI technique that was able to see the fourth nerve as it kind of was traversing through the various cisterns, ambient cistern, around the peduncle, toward the it had its own pore into the dura as well, sort of long skinny course, and then meets up in the cavernous sinus with the third nerve, because it starts off a little bit below where the third nerve is, but it has to get up to the superior oblique. So it has a bit of it has that long course, and then it kind of moves superiorly as it traverses forward. And of course it gets to the superior oblique outside of the muscle ring. So the muscle ring, or the annulus of Zinn, is there in red. And the fourth nerve is one of the nerves that's outside of the muscle ring, because it's getting to that superior oblique. Here's another example of fourth nerve palsy. A couple of features here that I didn't mention is when patients look away from the side of the lesion. So if they look contralaterally, if you look at that leftmost image, you can see that the eye, as the patient looks, the eye tends to go up like this, sort of like this. Nasal upshoot with adduction. So it's a hypertropia. And the hypertropia is also worsens on head tilt toward the side of the lesion, okay? It doesn't give you a ton of information to tell the difference between with what's called a skew deviation, which always confuses me, but this is the general idea with fourth nerve palsy. If you see a nasal upshoot and worsening on ipsilateral head tilt, it's suspicious, at least for a fourth nerve palsy. And again, you can see how you may be able to use the Hirschberg test. So it looked in the middle image, you can see that those two dots on the patient's right eye are right in the center of the pupil, whereas on the patient's left eye, they're sort of toward the bottom of the pupil. Now, provided the pupils are about equal size, you can use that to give some idea of what the deviation might be. Does that make sense? So that's the Hirschberg test. It's a qualitative test. Okay, so this patient with a pineoma, lid retraction, upgaze palsy, the diagnosis is Parinaud syndrome or dorsal midbrain syndrome, which is sort of more typical. I know the case I showed you is not a typical cause of fourth nerve palsy. And then the other features that you should know are convergence, retraction, nystagmus, and pupillary light near dissociation. Okay. So this is a 50-year-old man with acute diplopia, which is worse on right gaze. And if you look at the patient, the image on the left, you can see when the patient tries to look to the right, the left eye does not adduct, does not go in. And so this is pretty typical for internuclear ophthalmoplegia, and the patient has a hemorrhage in the midbrain at the medial longitudinal fasciculus. And here's a picture of it. Here's a video of it. So you can see when the patient looks to the right, the patient's right. So this way, that looks pretty much normal, a little bit of end gaze nystagmus. Now you can watch that right eye has sort of a lag. See how it's kind of lags behind. So that's sort of more subtle internuclear ophthalmoplegia. It lags behind. And then there's also on the left eye, there's nystagmus. You see that? So those are the two features. Okay. Adduction lag, and then more prominent nystagmus on the more normal eye. See that? And the reason why I think that this is important is that there's a long list of differential diagnoses, and some of which are operative neurosurgical problems. So you should familiarize yourself with this finding, okay? Here's another one, 51-year-old man, double vision, has pus coming out of the left ear and pain behind the left eye and a headache with this finding. Anybody, I know this is the same slides I've been showing for the last 4 years. So if somebody who hasn't seen it, does anybody know what this is called?
Is this Tolosella?
No, no, good guess.
It's the other name.
Gradenigo. Nice, okay.
You gave me the wrong answer.
So Gradenigo, it's... Oh, he gave you the wrong answer and then he took the credit? That's treacherous. That's treacherous. We don't see this that often, but this is a six nerve palsy plus retroorbital pain and mastoiditis or petrous apositis. Here's another example of that. This is a patient with who has double vision for about 4 weeks. It's a mild disc edema and a sixth nerve palsy, which means an abduction deficit. Okay. This is sort of a zebra type case. Does anyone know this one? Okay. Good. All right. Cool. Yeah. Learn me Duclos, which is evidently it's not neoplastic, but it's lesion that grows and the there's an increased cellular layer, and then there's these increased vacuoles, and then there's more blood vessels than you would expect. So that's the pathway of the abducens nerve is it sort of goes down and then it does exit from the ponds. They're at the bottom of the ponds. It does exit much lower, and then it kind of travels along the clivus up toward the cavernous sinus. And it's not altogether clear to me why. I know we talk about this every time, like why elevated intracranial pressure causes six nerve palsy. And I think just as a general, it's fixed in certain places. And then if you have some measure of herniation, central herniation, I guess it's either a stretching or it pushes on there, and then it's fixed at where it enters into. So it exits the midbrain or the pons into the cistern, and then it goes up and enters the dura a bit more superiorly. And it must be fixed there as it enters the Durello canal under the Gruber ligament. And so perhaps that causes some stretching along that canal. I'm not totally sure, but we know that we see occasionally with increased intracranial pressure, we see six nerve palsy. That's probably the more common one to see. And there it is coming out of the Durello canal and into the cavernous sinus there. So good. Good. I think so. The pupil, one thing to know about the pupil is it's rich with information. There's a lot of information that you can get from the pupil objectively that when a patient comes in and we suspect that and they're complaining of vision loss, but we suspect that they're lying, the truth always comes out from the pupil. Okay. The pupil is sort of, gives you a ton of information. If you know how to examine and understand the pupil, you can get a lot of objective, useful information from that. Okay. I've showed a lot of different pathologies here. There's a third nerve palsy up on the top. There's another type of third nerve palsy, which is sort of more ominous kind. Here's Horner's syndrome here on the very right of the screen. There's a congenital Horner's syndrome. But with the congenital Horner syndrome, you can see that the eyes are oftentimes two different colors, and then various different types of pupils. And then the one in the center shows the patient having a light, shining in one eye, and it doesn't really respond. But then when they look at something up close, it does respond. That's called light near dissociation. Okay, so the pupil can give you a ton of information, and I'll show you how to examine the pupil. But the key things that you want to look at is how big is it, how reactive is it, how equal are the two? And then if you're feeling enterprising, you can try to look for an afferent pupillary defect, but really it's size, reactivity, and equality. If you can learn how to really observe well those things, there are these little tools. You can get a pupillometer. I know now these days in the ICU, they're using these pupillometers for all kinds of monitoring of intracranial pressure. I don't know if the ramifications are fully understood yet, but I think that that's going to become more and more useful. Marcus Gunn pupil is an afferent pupillary defect. Ades tonic pupil is a condition that causes a type of partial third nerve palsy, just affecting the pupil. So afferent pupillary defect means, we'll see it in a second, means, I think I have this video here. Yeah, here. This is an afferent pupillary defect, okay? So that's also known as a Marcus Gunn pupil. So you shine light in one eye, it constricts, you go to the other one, it dilates. Means this patient's right eye is not seeing, it's not receiving as much light as the left eye. Okay. This is sort of the consensual response, right? Ades tonic pupil means that the fibers that are control constriction, which is the parasympathetic fibers of three, for whatever reason are damaged, maybe viral or whatever. Efferent problem. Efferent problem. This is afferent problem. That's exactly right. So here's the pupillary light reflex arc. Here's a case of a patient who has, if you look closely, you can see on the patient's right near that letter A, that the pupil is a little bit smaller and that the lid is a little bit lower. Then if you ask the patient to look to the right, they also have a sixth nerve palsy. And this is one of those few times in ophthalmology where it really gives you exquisite localizing information. If you see a six nerve palsy with the Horner syndrome, it's cavernous sinus. It can't be anywhere else. Okay. One of those sort of neuro-ophthalmic pearls. It's the only time when the two of them are together. Okay. Rare, but you put it in the back of your mind somewhere and then maybe you'll see it someday. Okay. There you go. And obviously we're not going to go through the whole pathway of the sympathetics as they travel up the eye, all three neurons and so forth. It's quite esoteric. okay, this is a 29-year-old man struck on one side of the head. This is, you see some of the, something like this, it makes you really sad because we know that the prognosis of a fixed dilated pupil, unilateral or bilateral in the setting of head trauma is a very poor prognostic factor. So this is a coup contra coup injury with subdural hematoma and then herniation of the uncus. I don't presume to try to talk to any of you about herniation or brain trauma or anything like that. This was really mostly for my own understanding. But what is not totally clear to me, but which I imagine is when the uncus moves over the tentorial notch, there's a portion, that portion of the cranial nerve 3 is what's most exposed. And either it's compression or stretching or both. That's the way I imagine it. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but as the brain expands and the uncus comes over that tentorial notch, that portion of cranial nerve 3 is what's most affected. And it can affect it affects the parasympathetics first because those travel on the outside of the nerve. There's also a rare phenomenon, which if, let's say you're in the trauma bay and you see an oval-shaped pupil, this could be a sign of impending herniation or impending problem because it's the so-called dynamic oval pupil, where initial pressure on that pupil can cause an oval shape or movement of in a certain axis. Now, it's not the only cause of an oval-shaped pupil, obviously, but in the setting of a trauma where you have anisocoria, and that could be a sign that there's an emergency about to happen, okay? All right, so we can blast through this last part in about 5-10 minutes. This is the part that's sort of close to my heart, which is orbit and oculoplastics. It's pretty straightforward to measure. A lot of it is photographic. A lot of it is observation. Okay, when we talk about how to measure the position of the eyelid, we use this metric called the margin reflex distance. Okay, again, that corneal light reflex, the distance to where the eyelid margin is, that's the margin reflex distance 1, as you can see on the top. That's sort of our metric that we use to measure the position of the upper eyelid. Hertel exophthalmometry or noggle exophthalmometry, we use to tell the axial position of the globe. And obviously facial sensation, we both know how to test. So in the eyelid, we look at margin reflex distance. I also look at how far the eyelid moves from down gaze to up gaze. And then I ask the patient to close their eyes gently. I always say this, close your eyes like you're sleeping. Because if you ask them to close their eyes, sometimes they do this and you can't see the subtle. And so close your eyes like you're sleeping. And then you can see if they have lagophthalmos. This was a patient of mine. He'd been complaining of left eye irritation. And I noticed he had some trouble closing that eye. And so I sent him for a scan. And it's nice to get these kind of thank you notes every now and again. Okay. So this is an example of mechanical ptosis. This patient has an encephaloceal that's probably pushing on the levator muscle with the defect in the superior part of the orbit on that left side. Here's how you look at globe position, which is this Hertel. I have a paper that I wrote on skull base, ophthalmology for the skull base, pathology and examination. And I describe in detail if you're curious, you can look that one up. Here's what it looks like to have axial displacement, for example, in the case of a sphenoid wing meningioma. And the worm's eye view is the easiest way to see that, which means from underneath. This is one, again, from Cushing's case logs. This is a patient with an optic nerve glioma, and you can appreciate on the right side both an axial proptosis as well as an exotropia. Okay, it's hard to tell with the light reflex, but you can see that the eyes are kind of pointed out. It's because the right eye isn't seeing very well. Here's an example of both axial, meaning the eyes pushed forward, and non-axial, the eyes pushed down in the case of a mucocele, and that's relieved once with the reconstruction of the orbital roof and evacuation. Let's see if we can play this. So orbital roof defect in some cases can cause this phenomenon, which is the so-called pulsatile proptosis, where you have the normal pulsations of the brain, and the dura, which is harder and more firm than the orbital tissue, are transmitted to the orbital tissues. Facial sensation, just a couple of case reports. This patient came in with binocular double vision, as well as sort of a dull pain in the right eye and loss of vision on the right side, was noted to have recurrent nasopharyngeal carcinoma in the cavernous sinus. And for this level of damage and destruction to the cornea, the patient usually should feel something because the cornea has the highest pain sensation in the body. highest pain sensation in the body. So the patient should be feeling, and the fact that they only feel a dull pain is indicative of that there's a serious problem. All right, when you do ophthalmoscopy, yeah, go ahead.
From when you do surgery, patients wake up and they all like meet to their eyes because they put like lotion and stuff on and they try to clear it away. And anesthesia, we always tell them, don't touch your eyes, your eyes. Like, is that true? Cornea has the highest sensation.
Unlikely. Unlikely. Yeah. Usually the problem, I think that's a really good question. I think that's really good. First of all, when I was a resident, we did a study where we looked at patients in the ICU and patients post-op, and a lot of them have unrecognized cornea and eye problems. Unrecognized. It was about 30% we found. Okay. We just trolled the list and went through and then checked patients to see if they had problems. And usually the most common problem, it's not abrasion necessarily or mechanical damage, it's exposure. So the eye's not closing all the way. It's pretty unlikely that somebody's going to rub their eye, especially in that setting, and actually cause damage. But what's much more common is that the eye's not totally closed during surgery, and then it dries out. Okay. So if you want to do ophthalmoscopy, right, we'll practice it together. Again, I brought a few. You hold it in your right hand. You look through your right eye at the patient's right eye. And that way your nose doesn't hit theirs. You have to get pretty close. And if you can... I mean, it seems like basic stuff, but if you don't remember these things, then you're not going to be able to do it right. And then you can't gather useful information from it. But if you practice it, you can get good at it. And it's something that you could just gather information quickly. I remember I used to get called for, you know, by neurosurgery when I was a resident to come rule out papilledema. And, you know, there'd be this crying four-year-old who wanted to go home. And then if you're able to do it right, and you can actually look in there and send the kid home. And then, you know, they're good. They don't have papilledema. So if you can get good with something like this, if you have the time, if you can get good with something like this, maybe you can gather some useful information once in a while. I think so. You can darken it for maybe a couple minutes. If you have a time in the clinic, darken it for a few minutes. That'll dilate the pupil a little bit. Also have the patient fixated at a distance. That dilates the pupil a little bit, okay? We know that Harvey Cushing understood the value of ophthalmoscopy. And he actually knew that he could see patients with this diagnosis because he saw the vessels, but it's very hard to see out to the periphery with direct ophthalmoscopy. What's this condition? Anyone? This is von Hippel-Lindau. Cerebellar hemangioblastoma as well as retinal hemangioblastoma, okay? Okay, here's another one where you have a one side that has disc atrophy and one side that has disc edema due to a tumor that's pressing on one nerve causing atrophy, but also causing elevated intracranial pressure, which is causing edema on the opposite nerve. You don't get edema in an atrophic nerve, by the way. Once the tissue is gone, it doesn't swell anymore, okay? So what's this condition called? Foster Kennedy, good. Okay, here's another one, a patient with, after a trauma, head trauma, the patient has these tortuous vessels. Even after adding phenylephrine or like basically like Visine to the eye, they still have these curlicue vessels on the conjunctiva. And then you look in the back, you see on one side, on the same side as those curlicue conjunctival vessels, you see this swollen retinal veins. Okay, swollen and tortuous retinal veins, which is indicative of CC fistula. Okay, this is my final sort of public service announcement before we can start practicing a little bit. When you use the term papilledema, it means bilateral optic nerve swelling due to elevated intracranial pressure. Okay, that's the term papilledema. When you use that, that's what it means. Both eyes have a disc that's swollen because the intracranial pressure is high, okay? Disc edema is sort of even broader. So it's like, if you look at a Venn diagram, there's disc edema, which is all of them, and then papilledema is a smaller circle inside of it, okay? And pseudopapilledema, oh, by the way, so on MRI findings for actual papilledema, you see some flattening or contour change of the posterior globe, and you see on some T2 signal around the optic nerve, okay? That's sort of the couple of telltale signs on MRI. On CT, if you see something like this, this is not papilledema. This is calcified drusen, which can look a lot like papilledema. And I'll tell you, I saw a patient who had calcified drusen, who was sent and actually had a shunt put in for many years and had low pressure headache for a while until somebody figured out that she had calcified drusen, took the shunt out, and she got better. So it can happen. You know, you can make a error of judgment in doing a procedure if you don't have the right information. Okay, so this is optic nerve head drusen that you can see on CT. So MRI is good for actual papilledema. CT is good for calcified drusen. And if you have a suspicion about calcified drusen and you're not sure, you can send to the ophthalmologist and they have these tests that they can look for the buried drusen, which are these deposits under the disc. Okay, I think that pretty much covers it. I think I finished pretty much on time. Good. Any questions about what you, yeah, go ahead.
It is a really great lecture. Thank you for coming. On the topic of Tursan syndrome, should we be, I guess, what's the incidence? And I imagine that varies with like the fissure grade of the hemorrhage. But I wasn't aware that it scars down. I was under the assumption that it kind of goes away once the subarachnoid hemorrhage resolves. So this all suggests that we should be like, you know, really doing ophthalmologic exams in high grade fissure patients and then calling you if there's any ambiguity about it.
I don't think that's unreasonable at all. In a high grade subarachnoid hemorrhage patient, obviously they have bigger fish to fry, you know. But if for some reason, once the sort of dust is settled, they don't have vasospasm or whatever, you made sure that they're stable, it wouldn't be a bad idea to get an eye exam at some point, because there's not really much you can do about it from an eye standpoint. So it's not like there really isn't. It's not like you can go drain the hemorrhage necessarily. So I don't think it necessarily makes logistical sense, but it would be a good idea as sort of part of the rehabilitation plan to make sure that that's figured out and addressed and that the patient understands the ramifications of why that's happening.
You talked about sometimes you look at optic nerve sheath that is with ultrasound and how sensitive or specific that is with elevated ultrasound.
I think it's a good question. I don't think that that's, at least from my understanding, a very reliable measure. I know the emergency room likes to use it, and I'm sure we'll have more information, but you know, I guess the one-liner is that it's pretty operator dependent. So if you have somebody who does it all the time and then you have some kind of correlation, then maybe you could trust those results. But it's not something that I have a lot of, as a diagnostic test, that I have a ton of familiarity with, and might be center specific or operator specific. So yeah.
Great talk, Justin. Can you speak on optic nerve sheath penetration for pseudotumor and what the barriers are for ophthalmology or arthroplasties in doing it? If it's worth doing versus just going straight to shunts, if it's like just a visual problem, not like severe headaches, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. If patient has headache, shunt is probably the best neurosurgical, the best option overall, and that will address the. But if they just have eye findings without a prominent headache, then obviously doing a nerve sheath fenestration is not going to help with headache, but it can help with the eye findings. And it's something that's pretty straightforward for, you know, our fellows that are sitting back there to do. So it depends on what the most pressing issue is for that particular patient. There are patients who have shunts, still have vision loss that we end up doing fenestrations on, which is possible. But that's really the main, as far as I understand it, the main separator. If headache is a big part of it, you do a shunt, you can try to address everything. But if it's really mostly vision loss, minimal headache, then a optic nerve sheath fenestration is the move.
And would that be enough to stabilize them for months so that they can try to lose weight and things like that? Or
right, it can at least keep the nerve stable while they get on Diamox and lose weight.
So you kind of just follow up on that. I think what one's getting at is that they aren't done here. Are we just calling the wrong service? So should we call oculoplastics rather than
call us
their ophthalmology? Because you ask and they're always rejected.
Katie, you like doing them, right? She's lazy. Oh, yeah. If somebody like Connie is doing it, maybe 15 minutes, something like that.
Would you say that it's is it a technically demanding or dangerous surgery? Is it hard to do?
I think you just need practice, but it's not like you have to spend a lot of time opening or closing. It's pretty straightforward to access the nerve, but it does take some technical understanding not to damage the nerve when you do something like that. So we do it under the microscope. We actually use the inner ear instruments oftentimes and just take off a little window of the dura or the optic nerve sheath.
What is the approach?
There are a couple different ways you can do it. You can go through the medial upper eyelid crease. Okay. You can go through the caruncle, which is that, you know, kind of that fleshy part of the conjunctiva there medially. And some people will actually take the medial rectus off temporarily and then put the eye into abduction, so it makes the nerve available. Others can just, you can just find it another way. I have to admit, like, I've done probably half a dozen of them. And I've noticed that for the fellows, for some people, it comes really naturally. And for some people, it's just really, for me, it's always been like kind of tough to do. So I usually just let fellows do it. But yeah.
For the IIH slide, you were saying that they get transient blurry vision with bending over and standing up. But in terms of ICP, those are kind of like opposite things. Like usually ICP falls when they stand. So why would...
I'm not totally sure with postural change. It's a good question. You know, I have to admit, I haven't talked to enough patients to really fully understand what that's like. But I know that it can be when they, you know, when you have an increase in ICP or a decrease in perfusion. So it's like sort of like that. That's sort of the way I think about it.
It might be straining. There's obese patients are trying to get up from a sitting position.
Valsalva. Yeah, that could be true.
Hyperthyroidism and it's of dogwoods. They're bilateral. Is it because of the fat tissue overgrowth? What's
like muscle and fat? Those two things. So there's we separate them into like a different types of disease. One type is with sort of much larger muscles, and the other one is with expansion of fat. Usually, if it's compression of the nerve and with you have greater oxophthalmos, when it's mostly a muscle disease. But you can have a lot of bulging with fat as well. But it's typically some measure of both.
And always bilateral.
Not always. The most common cause of bilateral proptosis is thyroid eye disease. The most common cause of unilateral proptosis is thyroid eye disease. Proptosis due to thyroid eye disease is more common than proptosis due to any other cause combined. Okay, so thyroid eye disease is like the most common orbital disease by far.
I want to echo, it's a great talk. One of the things that, you know, we love working with your group, it's a mystery to me, is why you so seldomly reconstruct the orbital roof. Because you showed a really nice slide of pulsatile, I guess I used to call it exophthalmos, you call it proptosis. But every time we ask, you go, oh, no, you don't need to. I mean, it's just so rare that you actually do. When do you need to reconstruct it? How much of the orbital surroundings have to be missing before you get it? Does it have to be a CSF leak? I mean, what is it? That's a mystery to me. Of when
you pull the trigger, a lot of anger and anxiety coming out. It's like question answer session.
So I think that with a traumatic orbital roof fracture and traumatic lateral wall fracture that you see, the fat is going to tamponade it, right? Most of the time. So CSF leak is not that necessarily that much of a consideration. Pulsatile exophthalmos is a consideration. And I suppose that if a patient, let's say after tumor resection, has pulsatile exophthalmos, it's not like you've necessarily burned any bridges. I see what you're saying, that it's probably a good idea to go in and do it at the time and just get it done. But I think that we've had cases where we've gone back later and put in hardware. And Goldberg has just kind of nailed into us that the less hardware you put in there, the better, because I think over his career, he's taken out a lot of hardware. So I think that it's more of a style thing that we've kind of been indoctrinated into. I don't think there's any harm in it, especially when you end up with a patient like this who's complaining of oscillopsia, you know, the sensation that the world is moving. So I guess in the case of, we talked about this in terms of meningiomas, how the once you take out the sphenoid wing, do you reconstruct it? And in that case, I guess the dura is kind of thick. You don't necessarily have to because they don't get as much pulsing. But in these cases where you do have pulsatile proptosis, maybe it's something that you can come back later and do. I don't know if I have a good answer for you. Yeah.
All right. We'll leave enough time for you to.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. So whoever wants to, whoever wants to learn. But thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions or comments to ausman@snidigital.org. From UCLA Neurosurgery and supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and Medical News Network. Thank you.